We know what time Ardiff Wood went missing. We know you were there.
Come on, tell me.
There's no DNA because I'm not there.
That's
if there was DNA, you guys have already arrested me for it.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed, and for the past 2 decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who lived through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun, dun, dun.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome to episode 76 of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, longtime true crime producer Ed Hydock, along with my bestie, the biggest turkey of them all, Melissa Spivey.
It is not time for turkey jokes. We're still in October. Last week I was the caramel to your apple.
My friend, this is the first week of November. Oh. Despite us recording in October.
My bad. Wink, wink.
Well, it is November, as Melissa just alluded to, or at least I alluded to.
Oops.
Which means new theme, new block, new month, new whoop, things.
Whoop. All the things.
Well, this month we have picked what we think is a pretty cool theme, and we're going to be talking about cases that involve forensic sketch artists in a block we're calling Drawn to Justice.
I'm so excited for this theme. I feel like I've been saying this since like day one that I wanted to do something with forensic sketch artists. So I'm pumped because they're creating something from someone else's brain.
Right. There's a whole science behind it, which we are going to learn so much about this month. And I also want to mention that there was a great dad joke opportunity. Like, I wanted to call this block hand turkeys. Do you remember in elementary school, the sketches we used to do?
Yes.
The hands. We went against our better judgment because I didn't want to undermine the work that our guest does. So we're not going to mention who that person is, but I didn't want to disrespect his work by calling it hand turkeys, as hilarious as I thought it was. Regardless, before I turn it over to you to get into this week's case, do we have any business to attend to?
Think so. Just a reminder that we're going to be launching our Patreon come January. Definitely be on the lookout for that. I think we have some really cool things planned. And if there's anything that you guys want to see or hear or think would be cool, please hit us up. Send in those ideas. We were even thinking maybe if you'd be interested in something like an AMA, Ask Me Anything kind of thing, where you can ask Ed like all your burning true crime TV questions.
Oh, yes. Like how we get 4 hours sleep and run on snacks and Starbucks most of the time. It's really the American dream, if we're being honest.
Yeah, you've had a week. Maybe we'll talk about that at the end in our banter about your week shooting.
Tell you all about it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, today, I'm going to be sharing with you the tragic case of Ardith Woods, and we're leaving the U.S. for this one. We aren't heading too far, but we're still out of the United States because our case takes place in Ottawa, Canada today.
America's hat.
Exactly. So Ottawa is known as being a generally safe city, especially as cities go. I mean, obviously, everywhere has issues with crime, but bigger cities tend to see more of it, and compared to like a lot of the cities over here in the U.S., Ottawa might as well be Mayberry.
Well, can anyone compete with the U.S. as far as crime goes?
No.
But being honest,
yeah.
But go on.
Go for us. Well, that feeling of safety, that was going to change in the early 2000s when a string of sexual assaults would begin occurring on the bike paths in Ottawa. And I need to get this out of the way. Ottawa has an insane amount of bike trails. Like, we're talking 200 kilometers, which is about 125 miles just in and around the city. It's honestly, if you look at a map, it's spectacular. Some of these paths are apparently incredibly isolated. Like, sometimes you'll be kind of in a forest area. Sometimes you'll be in a residential neighborhood. It's just kind of all over the place. And before this specific string of sexual assaults, it almost seems like safety was never really a big concern on these paths. Like, I'm sure if you were going out at night by yourself, you know, you you gave it some concern, but I don't think it was like, where's my pepper spray? Where's my, you know,
yeah,
all the stuff we have to bring now.
And it's a shame you have to worry about that stuff, because I feel like when you go on these paths to hike or to bike or whatever, you're going out there for peace and serenity.
Right. Like, we can't, this is why we can't have nice things, because the people like I'm going to talk about today.
Yeah.
So it's the morning of Wednesday, August 6, 2003, and we're in a section of the city on the northeast end of Ottawa called Orleans.
Okay.
And in the United States, our cities, I mean, a lot of our cities, I should say, have neighborhoods. Like in Philly, we have Old City, Frankfurt, South Philly, Grays Ferry, etc. So I'm honestly not sure if Orleans is a neighborhood or more like a suburb on the outskirts of the city.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's more of a neighborhood, but I'm not 100%. So Ottawaians, please forgive me.
Ottawawas.
Ottawaians, yes.
I actually looked it up. It is it's just a neighborhood.
Oh, is it? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, now we know. So 27-year-old doctoral student Ardith Wood is at her family's home in Orleans, and she's visiting for a few weeks before her classes gear up again. And Ardith was going to school. She was pursuing her doctorate degree in philosophy at the University of Waterloo, right?
Smart cookie.
And the university was about 5 hours from home. So between the distance and like her dedication to her studies, she didn't often get to spend a whole lot of time with her family, so this was a really welcome vacation to be home for a little bit. And she and her family were really close. It was Ardith, and then it was her dad, Brendan, her mom, Catherine, and then she had two younger brothers, Colum and Crispin. And they were like, when she was 27, one was like 22 and one was 24, so they were all pretty close in age.
Colum, you said? Like Colum?
C-O-L-U-M, Colum.
Colum. Okay. It's a strange name. Between Ardith and they're very unusual names. They're cool. They're just different.
They're really cool. Yeah, they're different, but they're really cool.
Yeah.
And Brendan and Catherine had chosen to raise their family in Ottawa. And by all accounts, like everything I read, everything people said, Ardith and her brothers really grew up having a safe and stable and just loving, happy home life. So Ardith was incredible. You already alluded to this, but she is incredibly intelligent and driven. After she graduated high school in 1994, she attended Carleton University in Ottawa, where she studied history and philosophy. After that, she went on to grad school. And at the time of our case, she had been working to finish her doctoral thesis, and then graduation was just right around the corner.
Wow, she was putting in the work. Sounds like she had a great career ahead of her.
Oh, she would have. Like, she had shit planned out.
Yeah.
And she was known to be an exceptional student, and she could discuss, like, these super deep and thought-provoking philosophical subjects, and she just came across as so incredibly wise beyond her years. Like, it wasn't like she was putting on a front.
Hmm.
Her ultimate goal was to be a full professor by age 35 and tenured at 40. And then mixed into these academic and professional goals was her dream of having a large family, with sources claiming that Ardith wanted to marry and go on to have 4 kids.
Oh, so I can't imagine having 4 kids and dive into these deep philosophical discussions. Just
yes, yeah. I can't even. I was like watching this TV show about her and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm exhausted just listening to your plans.
That's a lot.
But it does seem like at the time of our case that Ardith's plan really was on course. She had been seriously dating a guy for several years, and they had recently begun discussing marriage. So in addition to all of her other amazing traits, apparently Ardith was incredibly kind, and she was incredibly beautiful. She was really tall with this beautiful, long, golden blonde hair, and she kind of gives me Claire Danes vibes.
Oh, just the kind of like that classic beauty.
Yes, very classically beautiful. And many people, especially women, were often intimidated by her at first. She's so smart and she's so beautiful. But as soon as they actually like started a conversation and got to know her, they would just fall in love with her and become
she was like down to earth.
Yes. So on top of everything else, Ardith was really active. She loved jogging and bike riding, and she was often found swimming laps for like hours at the university pool. Yeah.
Cool.
She's like the whole package.
Sounds like it.
But we probably wouldn't be talking about her on this episode if things did not go terribly wrong.
Yeah, it's always bittersweet because you can tell this woman came from a loving home and literally has the world by a string, because you're thrilled that person has such a great life. But at the same time, it also means they probably were a truly innocent victim. Like this person you're talking about, I don't see this girl putting herself in any situation that would be dangerous or divert from the life she's living now, the straight and narrow. She's like got a goal and she's going for it.
Agreed. And I think that she would have gone on to do really wonderful things.
I believe that based on that little description.
Yeah. So let's get into our case. It's the morning of August 6, 2003, and Ardith wakes up at 6 a.m. because even on vacation, she was still very disciplined and she wasn't going to let rest and relaxation throw off her game. Like she was down to chill, but she's like not going to fall into like lazy vacay mode.
Good for her.
So she wakes up 6 a.m. and she goes on a run. When she gets home, she got a shower. She hung out for a little bit around the house. And then she made some sort of strawberry dessert because she and her mom were cooking like family dinner that night.
Oh,
so she had made the dessert early. And this bears nothing to the story, but I just want to tell you, some reports said it was a strawberry marshmallow dessert, which I can't imagine what that would have tasted like.
I don't like marshmallows, so sounds gross.
Oh, bummer. After baking, Ardith and her mom had plans to go shopping like that afternoon, and then they would come home and start family dinner. So around noonish, Ardith told her mom she was going to go out for a quick bike ride, and then when she got back, she'd be about an hour or so, and then when she got back, they could go on their shopping trip. And she said she wasn't going to be gone long because obviously she knew they had plans, but she also knew like a big thunderstorm was heading their way, and it's August, so you know how those like big thunderstorms are, those crazy intense summer storms that don't last super long, but just the nasty dump ones. Rain.
Yeah, like the ones Florida gets like every day.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it was supposed to be a storm like that. So Ardith's mom was like, okay, like no problem, I'll see you later. So around 12:30 that day, Ardith, who was wearing black shorts and a white t-shirt, she took her brother's black bicycle, she strapped on a helmet, and she headed towards the many, many, many miles of bike trails that Ottawa had to offer. So, as we already know, it's supposed to rain, and after about an hour, the sky opened, and it just begins pouring. Mm. So, Ardith's mom isn't immediately concerned, but when she wasn't home, it's getting later, it's like 2 o'clock, 2:30, and she starts getting concerned, but then she's like, well, maybe she got caught in the rain, and she ducked into a store or cafe, and she's just waiting to let the rain pass.
Yeah, totally feasible.
Totally. I mean, there's been times at work where it's been raining really badly, and I'm like, I don't even want to walk to my car in this. Like, I'm just going to wait a little. Like,
yeah, just hang out. Sure. I do that in the grocery store sometimes. You know, they all have those metal roofs, and you can hear it when it opens up. It's it sounds like dropping marbles on the roof. It's like, I'm just going to shop for another 15 minutes until that.
Just going to take my time. Yeah. So her mom isn't like super concerned. But as the day wears on, she's getting more and more worried, and Ardith is still not coming home. No calls, nothing. So when the family gets home, they all go out looking for Ardith, but as I've told you, there are a ton, miles and miles of these bike trails, and nobody knew which way Ardith was planning on going.
Yeah, you're literally looking for a needle in a haystack, and I was actually just going to ask you a second ago if she had a usual route that she would take, because then you would start there, obviously.
I don't think so. I mean, she may have had a direction that she tended to go towards, but remember, she was also home visiting, so this wasn't like her normal routine anyway.
So, and she's old enough where she could just say, going out for a bike ride, and they just trust that she's, she's
27 years old, you know?
Right.
So by that evening, they're like, we cannot find her. We don't know what to do. So they decide to get police involved. And I'm not entirely sure how much happened that night, because again, she was 27, you know, I'm sure that they were not police, I don't know, that were super in a rush to get things started. But by the next morning, it was crazy. Like a massive search began on that Thursday morning, August 4th, 2003.
Wow.
And when I say massive, I mean, I'm saying it is still one of the biggest searches, if not still the biggest search that Ottawa has ever seen.
No kidding. And you know what? That's not, it's bad and good. And I say that because you almost always see these kinds of responses when the victim is a well-to-do young white female. I hate to say it that way.
I know.
Because it also makes things look bad when it's not a young, well-to-do white female and there's very little response. It's kind of, I mean, I appreciate that they did it in this case. We'll leave it at that.
So it's interesting you say that. I was flipping through newspapers.com and there was actually an article about another death that had happened like that day or right around there. And it was a young man in a not necessarily nice part of town.
There you go.
And they were kind of comparing, like, nothing was done. Like, you don't even know this guy's name. So I did save it. Maybe we'll talk about that, like, in a Patreon episode. Because okay. It was really interesting, the parallels they drew. And
it happens, sadly.
Yeah. Well, tons and tons of people came out. We had the OPP, which is the Ottawa Provincial Police.
Yeah, you know me.
I knew you were going to say something. I kept... yeah. We had the RCMP, which is the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. They were out there. Alongside them were the Canadian Armed Forces. And then there were like thousands of volunteers coming out to search.
Well, yeah, especially when you think about how many forests and just completely isolated areas there are in that part of the world.
Well, the media got on top of Ardith's disappearance pretty quickly, and police immediately urged the public to come forward with tips. And oh my God, did the public deliver? Phones were blowing up. Investigators, right around like the day one or day two, investigators got a call from a young woman who said she had been on the trail the same afternoon as Ardith, and she was on a trail heading towards Orleans. And as she's biking along, a young, early 20-something-ish, good-looking and well-built blonde man approached her, and he attempted to engage her in conversation, and like things are fine at first. I should note, though, that he was shirtless, which to me is off-putting.
Yeah, like, I mean, what time of year is this?
It's August.
So, I mean, it's warm, jogger. I personally don't think anything of that, but I'm a man, so I don't know.
I don't know. I don't want to see your pecs, sir. Put them away, please.
Put your nips away.
Exactly.
I'm just saying I see joggers all the time without shirts on.
And no, I get it. I think it's just the fact that he's creepy.
Yeah.
So then you add that in.
True.
So the woman tells police that, you know, the conversation was fine at first, no big deal. But then the man quickly became just like straight up creepy. He began trying to like lure her down this like isolated and heavily wooded trail. And she's like, no, like, I'm good. Thanks, though. And he just kept trying to like, come on, come with me, come with me, come with me. And like just got weird about it. And she finally was like, absolutely not. And he got upset with her. Like he started getting angry.
See, never mind. I take it all back. Get this guy a pervert sign.
Exactly. He's a pervert. Yeah. So this young woman, she takes off. And I'm honestly not sure if she was biking or running. I believe she was on her bike, but sources weren't clear. Okay. But she just went as fast as she possibly could. And she did not stop until she got into like a more public area in a residential neighborhood.
Good. Sounds like she got lucky.
Yeah, definitely. So investigators ask her to come in and they sit down with her and they interview her and they decide to bring in a sketch artist. And the artist sat the victim down and they spent hours together, like getting everything about the sketch just right. And Ed, I am going to send you the picture and I want you to describe it for our listeners.
All right, hit me.
All right, there you go. Did you get it?
Yes. So, okay, this guy, he's white. He's probably 20s, I would guess. He's got some very small sunglasses on. He reminds me of like G.I. Joe or some kind of like, it's medium length hair, but it's kind of in like a sort of pseudo crew cut. And I think he's got, it looks like little peach fuzz, like either on his, it's either a full goatee that's not really grown in or just on his chin.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's sketches sometimes are super generic. I would not say that this one is. I think this is a really good sketch. I do think it's hard because he's wearing sunglasses, so you can't see his eyes.
Maybe Yvonne Bess just isn't good at drawing eyes. And he just
maybe. And he's like, oh, let's just put sunglasses on him.
Dude's got a sombrero on. I'm not good with hair either.
Just add that in there. It's fine.
Yeah, but he's an average Joe.
Yeah. Well, police make the decision not to release the sketch to the public at this point because, and I didn't really ever think about this, but while these sketches can be very helpful, they can also be incredibly detrimental to cases.
They sure can.
A, they can get tips from everyone and their mother being like, oh, that's my friend, that's my ex, that's the guy at the post office, like everybody. And B, if this guy isn't our suspect, if he's just some random creep, then everyone is out here looking for someone they shouldn't be looking for.
1,000%. And like you mentioned, without being able to see his eyes, that's one less feature that will stand out. He looks like a normal, like he could be 100 different people that you pass on the street.
For now, they hold the sketch back from the media. However, the sketch is shared with artist's family, her boyfriend, some of her close friends, just in hopes that someone would recognize the man and be like, oh my God, that's so-and-so. But no one in her life has any idea who this guy can be. And I do want to note that the call that came in that led to the sketch, it wasn't the only call that police received from women talking about a creepy blonde guy on the trail. So it wasn't just like that one tipster. Other people called about it as well.
So it's a good lead.
Yeah, absolutely. So investigators are looking into artist's background, and no matter how hard they dig, they cannot find a single negative thing in artist's life.
See, this tells me immediately that this was some kind of random attack, like some dude striking women on the trail, which is horrifying because, again, like we mentioned, you're going to the trail for peace and serenity, not to be looking over your shoulder. Or it was someone stalking Ardith and followed her to the trail. But given that there were reports of this guy flirting with other women on the trail, I suspect the former, that it was just some creep on a trail.
Well, I suspect that your suspicion may be correct, but hold tight. So the searches for Ardith are still going strong. I mean, we got military helicopters flying all around, and they're all equipped with, like, heat sensors.
Yeah, FLIR cams, yeah.
Within a few days, they had searched over 35 square kilometers, which equals about 14 square miles or so. I got you, don't worry. For us non-metric system people.
Right.
But even with all the searching and all these people in all these different areas, they are coming up empty-handed. I mean, no sign of Ardith, no sign of the bike, the helmet, nothing.
Yeah, it's like the whole shebang just vanished into thin air.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, strange.
Well, tips are still coming in, and soon police get a phone call from a 16-year-old girl who I'm going to call Molly because A, I feel like it, and B, it's easier than saying the girl
over and over. I get that.
Molly claims that the day Ardith disappeared, she too had been biking on the trail, and shortly before it began to rain, she had been alone on the trail, and she thought she heard someone scream.
Oh, wow.
So she starts kind of looking around, and she sees a pretty blonde woman, who we believe to be Ardith, engaged in conversation with a blonde man, which matches up with our sketch.
That's our guy, yep.
And Molly thought that the guy looked angry, and he's, like, very animated as he spoke, which I talk with my hands, too. So I'm like, was he animated, or did he talk with his hands? But So Molly continues to watch the couple, and they're, like, walking further away from her, and they put their bikes down, and then they start down a trail towards Greens Creek.
Okay.
And Molly felt like something was off, but she wasn't sure what. Like, she felt like maybe this was just a couple having an argument, or maybe they were going off down this, like, isolated path for some, like, fun time, if you're catching my drift.
Yeah, I get. Well, it's also exactly like that other woman's eyewitness account, so that this blonde guy was harassing women on the trail, so.
Yes.
Yeah.
And trying to lure them away, right?
Yes.
And, but regardless, something just felt wrong to Molly. Something felt wrong in her gut. So this brave young lady, she decided to follow them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So she sees where they put down their bikes, and and she goes to, like, the top of the path that they went down towards the creek. And she's kind of hidden in brush. So it's not like she's standing right there.
Okay.
The man and the woman are out of sight, but Molly continues to listen. And again, she just gets this bad feeling. She just felt fear in her gut. And she just felt so much concern for the pretty blonde woman. She actually even pulled out her cell phone and dialed 911, but she never hit send.
Could you imagine being in that position? Like, I kind of get it. You don't want to call 911 unnecessarily, but her gut was clearly telling her something was wrong. And I don't think she could have saved that woman's life, but she could have at least triggered a quick police response and maybe the guy would have been caught right away.
I'm glad we're talking about this because this poor girl gets so much hate, like, online. I watched Murder, She Solved. All of the commenters are bashing this girl. And even the TV show is kind of like a little shady about it.
But anybody, put yourself in her shoes. Anybody.
That's
like
what
it's,
I'm saying.
It's so easy to complain and judge from a 10,000 foot view, but anybody would have probably done the exact same thing she did, especially at age 16.
Well, that's what I'm saying. This is a 16-year-old girl who is alone on an isolated trail, and people are so quick to call her out for, quote, not doing anything, when in reality, I feel like she did a lot more than most people would have.
Well, right. And I also imagine that she's kind of afraid to call police at 16. Mm-hmm. Like, what if the couple really was going to hike and like go mess around in the woods somewhere and she called police? Or maybe she'd get in trouble for calling the police. Like, she doesn't know. Like, I, at 16, I wouldn't know. I mean, unless I saw something blatantly violent and not right, I don't know if I would call because of a suspicion. Like, I totally get it.
I mean, ultimately, the only person to blame here is the monster who hurt Ardeth. Like, that's who we should be 100%.
Could not agree more.
Anyway, I think we should be grateful that Molly did call police when she saw the news broadcast about Ardeth. And this gave police a little bit more help, actually, when it came to pinpointing an area that really needed to be focused on. Because as of now, like, they had the tipsters from the first couple days, and they were like, well, I was in this type of area, but that wasn't, like, it didn't pinpoint to where they needed to be.
Sure.
So Molly was also shown the sketch of the suspect, and she was like, that is definitely the guy that I saw, 100%.
So that's the guy we're looking for then.
Yes. So she shows them kind of like where she was, and so the searches moved closer to the Green Creek area. And a few days after Ardeth disappears, the phones are still ringing, and a call comes in that's later to be determined that it comes from a payphone in the city of Gatineau. And before I get to the call, I just want to tell you that, like, the city of Ottawa, which is part of Ontario, it's next to the Ottawa River, and then across the river is Quebec. And there's several bridges from Ottawa to Quebec. It kind of reminds me of Pennsylvania and New Jersey with, like, the river splitting things up, and then we have all the bridges. Yeah. So this call comes in, and it's a man, and he's flustered, but he's telling police that he killed Ardeth. He said it was an accident, and he didn't mean to do it, but he had taken her across the river and buried her there in Gatineau. But then he hangs up.
Wow. So he's either taunting police or this is like a total prank call, which would be messed up.
So police are like, was that real? Because they've been searching Ottawa. They've been searching the park. They've been searching the creek. They're not anywhere near Gatineau and Quebec.
Right.
So they trace it. They figure out where it came from. But of course, by the time they get to the payphone, the caller is long gone. There's no fingerprints. Nobody remembers seeing anything, blah, blah, blah. So now investigators are like, well, shit, do we move our searches here? And if we do, where do we start? And I can't imagine, like, the position they must have been in because, you know, they're searching so hardcore in this one place. And now they have maybe a new site, an entirely new town, a whole different province, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you basically just doubled the size of your potential crime scene, and we just saw how many resources they've already expended in Orleans alone.
Yes, so, exactly.
Nuts.
So while they're trying to determine the legitimacy of the Gatineau phone call, they get another tip. And this time it's a woman who had been on the bike path in the same Green Creek area when a man approached her and began engaging in conversation. And when she describes the man, it's the exact same description that the first caller and other callers and Molly had described, and it looks just like the sketch. So the caller goes on to explain, though, that the man told her that he was from, I'm probably going to butcher this, Canada, I'm sorry, Platajna, which is a little town about 60 miles east of Ottawa.
Okay.
And this sticks out to police and the woman because Platajna is a small town and the name itself stands out.
Well, yeah, Platajna isn't exactly a name you hear very often.
Right. And maybe you don't hear it at all if I'm saying
ever.
It wrong.
That's the first time I've ever heard it. You've never heard it. Yeah.
So police feel like this is probably a really good lead, but like they aren't quite sure what it means yet. So the woman ends the call by saying the conversation with the man had started out harmless enough, but he quickly began to make her uncomfortable, trying to lure her to like a different area. So she pedaled away as fast as she could.
This is giving me Bundy vibes. Like he's going places with very little regard for his own identity and just looking for targets.
You're absolutely right. I didn't even think about that, but you're right. Like the day Bundy was at the beach going, hi, I'm Ted. Yeah. Hi,
I'm Ted Bundy. Hello, I'm Ted Bundy.
Oh, idiot. Well, meanwhile, back at the search site, investigators, volunteers, etc., they're doing these extensive searches in the area around Green Creek, but now it's time to actually search the creek itself.
Yeah, it sounds like
And just for our timeline, at this point, it's Sunday, August 10th. So Ardeth went missing on Wednesday the 6th, so we're like 4 days out.
All right.
Yeah. And so far, we have no physical evidence of anything related to Artemis. We got nothing. It's like she disappeared into thin air.
Yeah.
But that was about to change. So they have these divers in the creek, and it was super muddy and murky. The show I watched said that they literally had 0% visibility. So they're in the water, under there, grabbing around, hoping for the best. And that's terrifying. Isn't that so scary to be in like that dark water, cold?
Well, and searches are hard enough in the daylight, in clear. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, that deck stacked against them big time.
Yeah. Add in dirty, muddy water.
Ugh. Yeah.
Well, that afternoon around 1 p.m., they felt something under the water and discovered a black bicycle.
No, cue the crow.
Yep. So it was confirmed to be the bike that Artith was riding that day.
Mm.
So, well, this is really great evidence that they were in the right area. It's obviously a huge blow to Artith's family and friends. And police at this point can pretty much guarantee that, you know, we're not going to have a happy ending.
Right.
So the next day, they decide to bring in cadaver dogs. And they bring them right around where they found the bicycle. And unfortunately, just a few hours into that search, the naked body of 27-year-old Artith Wood was found on the east side of Greens Creek. Her body had been sort of concealed behind some trees in like this little sort of dip alcove. And it was about 25 meters or 83 feet from the edge of the water. Wow. So she had been in the water. She was obviously dragged out and taken to this spot. Her clothes were missing, and actually, to this day, we've never found her clothes. We have no idea what happened. Yeah, no idea what happened to them.
Interesting.
But even though she was naked, there were no signs of sexual assault, so we honestly don't know if she had been assaulted or not.
You think so, because when you find a naked female, it's usually the case, but that could also be a throw-off. Yeah.
Well, and especially because at this point, with all of these people, with all the tipsters coming in about this guy, you know, they have profilers being like, this is a sexual predator. So her cause of death couldn't immediately be determined. But during the autopsy, they do determine that they find algae in her lungs. So it's determined that she had drowned in the creek. Yeah. And it would eventually be released that she was forcibly drowned.
God, what a way to die. That's one of the worst for me.
You and I hate that and burning.
I know. Yeah.
That's like our no thank yous.
Right. Which is crazy because you think about the awful ways that we've heard stories about people dying. I feel like in some of these situations, it's over very quickly. I feel like you realize the panic.
I know. Like my chest hurts thinking about it.
Yeah.
Well, now we have Artith and we have her bicycle, but that's it. Like, there is no physical evidence. Neither the bike or her body had any foreign DNA. There's no fingerprints. I mean, there is no trace DNA anywhere. And they're kind of like, well, the heck do we do now?
Yeah.
So with very few options left, investigators make the decision to release the sketch to the public. And, you know, I told you they had been hesitant to do this because they knew it would open a can of worms and they would be inundated with tips, most of which would probably be fruitless.
Yeah, but, you know, you're at the point where you have nothing else. So you got to roll the dice at some point.
Yeah. I mean, what else are they going to do?
Yeah.
So they released a sketch of the suspect and wow, their initial concerns were on track. They got about 1,000 calls within 2 days of releasing the sketch.
Yeah, but one of those tips could be the tip. And that's the thing. Like, I know it's a mountain of stuff, but they're important. And it's easy for things to get missed, too, because you're trying to clear these quickly. And sometimes the truth is buried in there.
Yep. Well, they definitely have quite a pile of notes to go through. And unfortunately, the majority of these calls didn't really lead to a whole lot. It was a lot of like, oh, I think it's my brother. Oh, I think it's the guy at the post office. Oh, I think it's, you know. I want to take a break from the investigation for a minute and talk about Artith's poor family. They were incredibly close, and Artith's murder was unbelievably difficult for her father and brothers, but especially her mom, Catherine.
Well, yeah, I mean, this girl had such a good head on her shoulders, and it's always extra sad when you think about what she could have been. So I'm sure mom not only is dealing with the loss of her only daughter, but just the fact that her daughter was on such a great course.
Right. And she had done what she was supposed to do. She had been a good girl, you know, which just Life is so unfair.
It is. It really is.
Well, there was an article that was released after her body was found, and her poor mom is talking about how Ardith was like her go-to. Anytime Catherine had a problem, she would talk about it with her daughter because Ardith had such an incredible knack for understanding others and feeling empathy and seeing different points of view. And after Ardith's death, Catherine released a statement to the public. And in the statement, she's so gracious and kind, and she's thanking these searchers and she's thanking all the people of Ottawa who prayed for Ardith. And I'm sitting there reading this article and I'm like, you are literally living in your own personal hell and you are still so kind and gracious and appreciative. And I feel like that really says a lot about someone.
Well, yeah. And you can see why Ardith turned out the way she did, because clearly she was raised to be a good person by this amazing family.
100%. And like, just to further push this narrative about what a lovely family that Ardith was a part of, I want to read a piece of an article that came out in the Ottawa Citizen on August 14th, 2003. So this article was about how Catherine Wood had, quote, stunned observers by declaring forgiveness and lack of hatred for the person who killed her daughter, end quote.
Wow.
And then her brother, Reverend William Ashley, he was interviewed and he said, quote, my sister has a particular capacity or grace that she's received from God to be able to take that attitude, end quote.
Yeah, they are way better people than I am. And I'm sure I could get there eventually after a lot of years. But in those early stages, I would be hellbent on vengeance.
100%. Me too.
Yeah.
Well, on Monday, August 18th, 2003, Ardith Wood was laid to rest at Ottawa's Notre Dame Cemetery. There were over 600 people at the funeral and thousands of people were outside, like just there to show their support.
Mm-hmm.
And on the show I watched, they had footage of the funeral and they showed the massive crowds just outside and like they showed the fence around the church or the cemetery. And it was crazy how many people came out, but also like how many bouquets of flowers and stuff they brought. Her murder just shook Ottawa.
For these crime shows, we see funeral footage and video and news footage all the time. And when you see those lines wrapped around the block, I mean, you can instantly get a sense of who that person was and what she meant to the community, he or she.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Well, now the pressure is really on police to find Ardith's killer. The public wants answers and they want to see someone pay for her murder.
Right.
So I want to go back to the calls that came in after the sketch was released. I mentioned that they got something crazy, like 1,000 calls within 2 days. And they're going through all these tips and nothing's really standing out to them. And they're starting to get incredibly concerned that this case is going to go cold. So it's now a few weeks later. It's September 10th. So we're about a month out from when she was found. And they re-release the sketch. And this time they release a sketch of a tattoo that the suspect had.
Oh.
Was a very like rudimentary and simple tattoo of a bird, I guess an eagle with its wings spread, like on the guy's upper left arm, like right below your shoulder.
Yeah.
Well, similar to what happened when the original sketch was released, the tip lines are blowing up. Like one source was, we're like, people were calling about anyone and everyone with any kind of bird tattoo. Like it didn't matter if it was a Tweety bird tattoo on their ankle, they're calling. Like,
well, yeah, people want to help.
Yeah. Well, people were blown. Again, they, at this point, they're up to almost 4,000 tips, like from beginning to end. Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
Now we're hitting the year anniversary of Ardith's murder. And while police have definitely been doing their part and trying their hardest, the killer's still out there. So they have all these tips and we know they've talked to people and they had a couple red herrings that I haven't really gone into. But there had been a few people on their radar that looked really good for the murder. And there were times when they would bring these people in and they were like, we got our guy. But each time something would prove the person innocent.
That's exhausting, too. And it's demoralizing because there, when you go in thinking you got your guy and then it's the rug gets ripped out, it's like back to square one.
So in summer of 2004, investigators hear about an attempted sexual assault committed in the basement laundry room of an apartment building. A young woman had been walking down the street and this young 20-something blonde guy starts talking to her and she asks him for a cigarette. So he tells the woman that she can have a cigarette, but he left them inside and he's going to go get her one. So she says, okay. So he's like, why don't you come with me? So they walk towards his building, and I'm guessing this was like a house converted into apartments, not like a big apartment complex kind of thing.
Okay, yeah.
So they get inside the front door, and as soon as she walks in, he forces her down into the laundry room basement where he tries to attack her.
Oh, wow.
And I did see a few sources said he was successful in assaulting her, and I saw some that said it was attempted, so I'm not 100% sure how that ended.
Regardless, it was an attack of some kind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thankfully, the woman was able to escape, and we have very few details on the assault, so I'm not sure how investigators put two and two together, but they had their eye on a local man for this assault.
Okay.
His name, he was 24-year-old Christopher Myers. So they do speak to Myers about this, but there's really nothing to push it any further. So they kind of have to cut him loose. And that's the end of that.
Okay.
So the detectives working Ardith's case hear about this sexual assault. And when they hear the suspect's name, they're like, why does that ring a bell? Well, they quickly realized that they had spoken to Christopher Myers the year prior in regard to Ardith's murder.
No way. So he's in the file.
Yep.
Wow.
So they go back to the notes when they talked to him, and it turns out he had an alibi. His landlady reported seeing him in the late morning, and then he clocked into his restaurant job at 3:30 p.m. And at the time of the interview, this alibi essentially ruled him out.
If this turns out to be the guy, he was probably in those thousands upon thousands of tips that were trying to be pushed through, you know, roll him out, and maybe was not followed up on properly. Not to bag the police. That's a ton of work and a ton of things to get through, but that could be very well what happened. It was a quick check off.
We'll see. So even though he had this alibi, the investigators, they can feel their spidey senses tingling, and they want to talk to him. And these are the Ottawa police, not wherever he had done the assault.
Okay, got it.
But police don't know where he is, and I'm not even sure if they know to this day where he had been during this time. But finally, they catch up with him in February 2005. So we are like a year and a half out now from Ardith's murder. But police get word that Christopher Myers is back in the area. So the detectives decide to pay him a surprise visit at his home, and he agrees to chat with them. And when he opens the door, they are immediately struck by just how similar he looks to the composite sketch.
Why would you come back if you ran and you did this?
I know.
Now,
here's the thing. I don't know. Like, they're still going through all this stuff while they're looking for him. So, again, this timeline seems to drag, but we just have to remember how long these things take.
And maybe they're thinking, like, he's just a possible suspect, like a person of interest. So let's just wait it out and see where we get with other people as well.
Yeah, I don't think that they immediately rushed to him. I just think they were like, oh, that's interesting. Because remember, he didn't get in trouble for the assault. They just liked him.
Right. Okay.
So they're talking to him, and they mentioned they're there about Ardith and her murder. And he chats with them, and he's friendly enough. But before they leave, they ask him if he has a tattoo on his arm. And he says no. And they're like, well, can you show us?
Yeah, prove it.
Well, he removes his shirt. And they're kind of shocked, but there's no tattoo.
Oh, shut up. I thought it was going to be game over. Seriously.
Right?
In the story. Yeah.
So did they. They were like,
wow.
Let's see. So they still, though, they feel in their gut like something is weird here. But again, no tattoo. And we've talked about this before. Gut feelings do not qualify as legitimate means to convict.
Sure.
Regardless of how I feel about that. So they can't bring him in on anything, and they also can't get a warrant on anything, but they can ask him really nicely to please take a polygraph, which is what they decide to do. And Chris reluctantly agrees to come down to the station in a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hopefully they didn't hold their breath because our boy didn't show.
Well, yeah, why would he? But also, why would he come back to town? Because I would have thought that if he had momentum from, like, not having a bird tattoo, I would just be like,
right.
Hey, it's not me. You know, no tattoo, not the guy. Sorry, can't help
you. Yeah, I wouldn't have agreed to that. I'd been like, no, thank you. So the detectives go back to his folder because even though there's no tattoo, they just still feel like this is weird. And they take a look at the alibi he had provided, which, as I mentioned, the landlady saw him in the late morning, and then he was at work at 3:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this alibi had initially ruled him out, but When the investigators really think about it, they were like, would he have enough time to talk to his landlady, ride his bike from his home to the Green Creek area, kill Ardith, and then go to work, just like any other day? Like, you can just go to work.
Yeah.
Well, one detective decides to bike the route that Myers most likely would have taken. Not only did he make this journey in the time frame, but he had plenty of time left to spare. So this basically discredits Myers' alibi.
Yep. Not good for him.
No, not at all. So around the time that investigators are kind of putting all of this together, another young woman is attacked.
Really?
Yeah. In late April 2005, a young woman is walking home from work at night, and she had walked across one of the big bridges that connects Quebec and Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
And she's walking along, and this young 20-something blonde man riding his bicycle approaches her and starts trying to engage her in conversation.
Wow.
She's not interested, and she's like, leave me alone. Like, just straight up tells him, leave me alone. Well, he begins to ride away from her, but then he turns around, jumps off his bike, and grabs her.
Oh, my God. Terrifying.
Terrifying. He forces her into some bushes where he steals her bag and takes off.
Oh, wow. This is like a robbery. Weird.
Well, they believe that he, like, tried to sexually, was going to try to, but she kind of scared him off.
Interesting. So he just took what he could.
That's kind of a giant wuss.
Cut his losses.
So, of course, she calls the police. But again, we have this guy on a bike attempting conversation, forcing the victim in an isolated area. However, this attack ended up being classified as a robbery. So the homicide unit working on Ardith's case, they didn't even find out about it for about a month.
Wow. So it's incredible to me that if this does turn out to be Chris Myers, that he wasted zero time after being questioned by police, that he's back out doing what he does. Like, that's ballsy.
And then by the time the homicide unit even finds out that this attack ever happened, another attack had occurred.
Shut up.
However, this attack happened in North Bay, Ontario, which is like almost 4 hours west of Ottawa.
Okay.
And this is where our sketch comes back into play and basically saves the day. So this next attack, the one in North Bay, happened in mid-May 2005. So it's late at night and a young woman's walking home from work. We know how this goes. A good-looking 20-something man on a bike comes up, starts trying to talk to her. He's asking her, where are you going? Can I walk with you? Can I keep you company? And she's just like, no, dude, like, no, leave me alone. And he just continues to be creepy and pushy and annoying. Like, mind your business, dude.
It's ridiculous that this guy is still pushing his luck with police right under his nose.
Just wait until, like, you hear about all the stuff that he did. He tells her he's looking for an address and asks if she knows where it is. And she's like, yeah, sure, it's down that way. And she gives him directions. So he rides off, and I'm sure she starts breathing a huge sigh of relief.
Yeah.
Until a few minutes later when he reappears.
Oh, because he turned around again. Her.
Yep. And he forces her into some bushes. And apparently, I guess he was like trying to break her neck or something because she said he was twisting it so violently, she thought her neck was going to snap.
Oh my God. It's so gruesome.
So gruesome. So this badass chick is fighting like hell and she's kicking and screaming. And thank God, a homeowner hears her and turns on a light and opens the door. And this wussbag attacker takes off like the little bitch that he is.
Wow. Thank God is right, though.
Thank God, right? So obviously police are caught about this attack and they come out. And as they're looking around the area, they spot something in the grass. A cell phone.
Ooh.
And this is like 2005. So we're talking a small silver flip phone with like the short antenna, short thick antenna.
Like a razor. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it was the even thicker kind.
Oh,
yes.
I know the ones. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm sure police are like, this can't be our perps, right? Like, no one is stupid enough to leave their cell phone behind at the crime scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, turns out you can be that stupid because these North Bay officers are able to track the phone to a woman named Lynn Myers.
Uh-huh.
And she was able to confirm that the phone did, in fact, belong to her son, Chris.
Amazing.
Myers.
Maybe he dropped it and didn't even know it.
Yep. So as North Bay police officers are looking into Christopher Myers, one incredible and eagle-eyed detective realizes that Myers looks incredibly similar to a sketch he had seen in the murder investigation of Ardeth Wood.
Really?
Which is crazy. Like, I wish I knew this officer's name, because that's some pretty damn impressive investigatory skills to be like, so in the know and up to date about the sketch and Ardeth's murder. Remember, they're 4 hours away.
Yeah, it was like 2 years ago, too, or something.
Yeah, we're two years out. We're 4 hours away. Like, for this guy to look at that sketch and be like, damn, that looks that's pretty awesome.
Well, that shows how big her case, how much it spread to other agencies and how big of a story this was.
Yes, absolutely. So North Bay goes and picks Chris up and they bring him to the station and they call the Ottawa police and they're like, so, you guys want to come over? Like, we got somebody you might want to talk to. So Detective Jerry Kinnear from Ottawa, he makes the almost 4 hour trip to North Bay to talk to Christopher Myers. And when he gets there, he finds out that Myers had actually just gotten back from a bike trip because he loves biking so much. He had gone on a couple day long bike trip.
Just out biking, doing what I love.
So when he goes to speak with him, Detective Kinnear immediately notices like how chill Myers is. He's just very calm and mild mannered. I mean, people referred to him even as meek, which I always think is an interesting way to describe someone.
I would never describe a man as meek. I would describe meek and mild as a woman. Like a man, if he would be just be quiet or reserved. I feel like meek is a woman always. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know, but that's how people actually described him in newspaper articles.
Wow.
So the detective tells him, like, I'm here to talk to you about the Ardeth Woods murder. And he's like, Myers is like, yeah, okay, I know. I've already been spoken to. I've never hurt anyone in my life, blah, blah, blah. And as they're chatting, the detective asks Myers, do you have any tattoos? And yet again, Myers removes his shirt and still no tattoos. And Myers says to him, he's like, I don't have a tattoo. I've never hurt anyone in my life. Like, why am I here? So Detective Kinnear's like, all right, well, how about this? How about if you take a polygraph and then, since you're so innocent, that'll cross you off our list. Myers agrees. And this time he takes the test and unsurprisingly, he fails miserably.
Yeah, by this point, if you reject two polygraphs, I mean, they got to think. So he's probably just like, let's roll the dice and take one and see what happens.
Hope for the best.
Yeah.
But even though he fails, he still won't admit to anything. He's still saying, nope, had nothing to do with this. Nothing at all.
Right.
And as we all know, polygraphs are useless in court. You might as well shake a magic eight ball.
For this reason.
Yep. So they have to release him. Like, what can they do? But they still feel like this is their guy. So they begin digging deep into his background and they start talking to some of his friends. And my goodness, this guy is a monster. And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time discussing his life because I don't think that he's worth our time. But do you remember back in block two of Murder Unscripted, which was July of 2024, we talked about thrill killers and we talked about all the different types of killers. But one thing we brought up and didn't really get too deep into was nature versus nurture. Like, are killers born or are they made? I feel like Christopher Myers is exhibit A for the nurture column.
Really? Do tell.
Okay, so he was born on September 7th, 1980, and according to sources, his biological mother was an alcoholic who continued to indulge in her alcohol addiction while pregnant with Christopher.
I was just going to say, was she an alcoholic while pregnant? Because there are correlations.
Right. So we're already not starting out great. He was supposedly diagnosed with a mild form of fetal alcohol syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Also diagnosed with ADHD. PDD, which is pervasive development. Oh. We'll get there. Hold on. Pervasive development disorder and schizoid personality traits.
Wow. The trifecta.
Yeah. And just an FYI, PDD is like the former term for what is now known as ASD or autism spectrum disorder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it obviously gets way more complicated than that I'm not going to go into, but according to my research, PDD was kind of like an umbrella diagnosis for autism.
Sure. And it's interesting because I guess all it does is show that Myers clearly had factors working against him just even from his prenatal days, it sounds like.
Right. I mean, it just didn't start out well.
Yeah.
And things didn't get any better. Sources were vague, but it sounds like there was some pretty bad alcoholism going on with his parents, which led to some pretty gnarly abuse. And I'm not sure who was abusing who, if they were abusing each other and Chris or just Chris or what. But at the age of 4, Christopher was adopted by the Myers family, a seemingly lovely family from Ottawa. But unfortunately, this happy ending was not meant to be. In an article in the Ottawa Citizen newspaper, they did a write-up on Chris after all this came out and talked about, quote, harrowing accounts from counselors who worked with him as a child. And the article even said, quote, one of the counselors that worked with Christopher Myers as a boy said he was the most disturbed child he had ever seen. End quote.
So the flags were flying even back then. People were trying to say something.
Yeah. I mean, for a counselor to say this is the most disturbed child like that, I was like, damn, like that says something.
I don't know if people don't think that kids are going to grow up to be serial killers or killers in general, but killers happen. Killers exist. So like, if you see these signs early on, I think people need to take it seriously.
Yeah. And I do think that the Myers family tried really hard with Christopher, but at the age of 12, they turned him over to the Children's Aid Society, where he then bounced around foster homes until like he aged out of the system and then he was homeless for a while.
Yeah, so he felt not wanted. I mean, not to defend the kid, but geez. Yeah.
Exactly. And like, I want to preface this next part I was going to say by saying I don't feel bad for the adult that he became because he made his choices.
Mm-hmm.
But goddamn, imagine being an already kind of messed up kid, and then at 12 years old, the only family you ever really knew gives you back.
Yeah, they're just like, see ya, man. It's hard not to be a little sympathetic for this kid, but again, you're an adult, you just said, and you make your own decisions, and you clearly know right from wrong.
Right.
So that is no defense.
We can feel bad for the child and the 12-year-old. We don't have to feel bad for him.
Right.
So he ages out of the system. He's homeless for a while. And then he was able to kind of get on track. And for a time, he was able to hold down jobs. And he had roommates and girlfriends. But none of the above would last very long. And he wasn't staying out of trouble. He had some drug charges in 2000 and some stolen property charges in 2002. But for whatever reason, most of the charges were either dropped or resulted in some, like, pathetic probation kind of time. So police spoke with an old roommate that who had kicked Myers out after they had only lived together for a few weeks. Apparently he was just like a huge liar, like always always telling these wild tall tales, which I can understand not wanting to tell the truth about the shitty life he had lived. But I think that his lies were just so asinine that people were like, why are you bothering?
Yeah. Why even say anything?
Right. And then police also spoke to some of his ex-girlfriends, and this is where they hit pay dirt.
Interesting.
So the exes would talk about how Myers was physically abusive and how he would be sexually aggressive towards their female friends.
Oh, gross.
Which is like, that's terrifying and just so skeevy.
Yeah.
So the roommates and exes would also talk about how Myers would like go out at night for bike rides. He loved riding late at night and he'd be gone for hours. Like, it was just his thing. And then one of the ex-girlfriends happened to mention Myers loved temporary tattoos.
Oh, you're kidding. Like the ones we used to, as kids, you put water on them and you just
sponge it on yourself. Yes.
No kidding.
He freaking loved them. Like, they were like his thing. He had them all over. Weird. And when investigators showed the ex a picture of the eagle tattoo, she confirmed that he had definitely worn a fake tattoo, like that eagle one.
Wow. It brings it all home for detectives, too. It's like, that's the missing piece. Yeah.
You have to be like, how is there no tattoo? Like, and I would never think that somebody would put on a temporary tattoo because how old are you?
But also, who noticed the tattoo? Well, if this guy was shirtless, I imagine one of the witnesses.
Yeah, again, the witnesses what an idiot. Did, yeah. Right?
What an idiot.
He's not very bright. So between the failed polygraph and the information from the exes and the roommates and just like looking at all the similarities between all the attacks, police are pretty sure that Christopher is their guy. So when they show his photo to one of the victims, she apparently, like, the detective talks about how this girl just, like, almost got physically sick and threw up just looking at his picture. So police are feeling really confident, but there's still that pesky fact that they have literally zero DNA tying Myers to Ardeth.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of witness statements, a lot of circumstantial evidence, but nothing hard, no smoking gun.
Exactly. So on October 13th, 2005, police have another interview with Chris Myers. And this is a big deal because at this point, they need him to confess. Like, yeah. That is the only way they're going to get this man off the street. So they decide to bring in the big guns, and they bring in this lovely British gentleman. I loved his accent, named Martin Graham. And he is the Ontario Provincial Police Sergeant Major.
Wow.
And I've decided to dub him the perp whisperer because apparently he's really good at getting these shitbags to confess.
Oh, he's got the interrogation technique down.
Yeah. He's the perp whisperer.
I like it.
So they bring Myers into the interrogation room, and they did something that I thought was a really good idea. On the wall, they basically had all their evidence hanging up. So they had this huge map of Ottawa with points marking where all of the assaults had been and where all of the sightings of him had been. And then they also hung up his mugshot right next to the composite sketch. So, like, it's awesome. So closely mirrored the picture. It's wild.
Yeah, you don't have to say anything. He knows just by what you're basically telling him you got everything you need, but without saying a word.
Exactly. Like, this, yeah. I felt like this was such a good intimidation tactic. Yeah. Like, just showing him, like, here's what we know you did.
You're showing your cards without showing your cards.
Yep.
Yeah.
So Graham goes in and he immediately starts going hard at Myers. Like, we know what you did. We know you talked to her. We know what you did to Ardeth. Da, 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 da. And this angle didn't work so well.
We know what time Ardeth Wood went missing. We know you were there. We know you spoke to her.
But it was.
So when did you meet her?
I never have.
Chris, it's not an issue.
How do I know what the woman looks like?
I'm not interested. Like, Jesus. Come on, tell me.
There's no DNA because I'm not there.
That's,
if there was DNA, you guys have already arrested me for it.
Thankfully, he's able to subtly switch tactics and he starts softening up and appealing to Myers as, like, a friend? And this ends up taking a while, but oh my God, does it work.
Well, listen, you know, one of the things that I'm happy to do, can I get you a glass of water or something? We can talk through this. Let's get it from the back of your head. I know it's not going to be easy to talk about. I know that. She puts down her speed bike. You put down your mountain bike. Hug and kissed. And then what? Show me what you did. All right? Come here. Stand up. You know what? One of the best things you can do and the easiest ways to recall memory is to relive it. So you tell me what you did, everything you did. Put your hands
down.
Yeah.
Kissed.
And what did she do?
And then she kissed back.
Yep.
And then the girl walked up and then I took off.
And then you took off.
Yeah.
They might not have a full confession, but he has now put himself at the crime scene.
Right.
So they are ecstatic. And then on October 20th, 2005, 25-year-old Christopher Myers is arrested and charged with first-degree murder in the homicide of Ardeth Wood.
From what you told us today, okay, there's absolutely no doubt in mind, obviously, you are responsible for physically causing the death of Ardeth Wood, okay, on August the 6th, 2003. Obviously, I'm obliged to tell you that you're going to be charged with physically causing her death. Okay, do you understand that?
So he originally entered a not guilty plea, and they went through like preliminary hearings and all of that stuff. But right before the case was set to go to trial, they reached a plea deal with him.
That happens all the time.
And you know what? I think the family was very thankful for not having to go. Like, they had to go through already enough with the preliminary. They like really didn't want the actual trial.
Right.
So they made this plea deal. He would plead guilty to second degree murder and he also had to plead guilty to several of the sexual assaults that he had committed in robberies. Okay. And I'm sure there's more that we never heard of. And I know that there's more that I didn't have time to go into.
Yeah.
So nuts. During sentencing, Myers was given the opportunity to address the court and Ardeth's family, but just like the giant wuss bag that he is, he just shook his head. So Ardeth's mother read a victim impact statement, and she talked about how her greatest joy was bringing home her baby daughter, Ardeth, bringing her home from the hospital, and how her greatest sorrow was putting that same child in her grave.
God.
And then Ardeth's father's statement actually had to be read by the court because he just wasn't confident in himself to get through it without breaking down, which I think we can all understand.
Oh, hell yeah. I know for a fact I would be just like this guy. I mean, you lose your only daughter and then trying to explain or at least confront the monster that killed her. I don't know if I would ever get there without being able to hold back everything that's been building up inside me.
Well, then it was time for sentencing, and I know you're sitting down. I'm glad, listeners. I suggest you sit down because this is a goddamn joke. For once in my life, I am going to be thankful for the American justice system, as broken as it is and much as it sucks. This monster was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 10 years.
10 years? Seems like an insult based on what was done.
Agreed.
Ask me. But there's something going on behind the scenes that either the family just wanted this to be done with. And if they've already forgiven him, I can see where it's true. Like, you know what, let's put this under the bridge and just move on.
Well, and don't forget, this is also Canada, so they have different laws. And like, I mean, their sentencing guidelines are not as intense as the United States.
And it was second degree murder, and he did plea, and it's Canada, the nicest country in the world. So.
Right. Well, he has been up for parole at least once since Ardeth's murder in 2020, but thank God the parole board denied it. They believe he is still a risk to the public, which like, duh.
Yeah, you think?
I do have a bad feeling, though, that he will be walking among us at some point.
But how, if you take into account all of those other sexual assaults that he's linked to, like you can clearly see this pattern of destruction, and this guy will not stop. He will get out and just pick up where he left off. It's a
agreed.
Fact.
You can't fix him. And he admitted to the parole board that prior to Ardeth's murder and the other assaults, he had committed several assaults against sex workers who had never reported them.
Canada, come on.
He's never fully admitted what happened that day. That hot summer day down that isolated path. Police do have their theories, and I just wanted to touch on this real quick. They believe that he somehow lured Ardeth down the creek and forced her to undress. And they think that he then went to attack her, but she jumped in the creek to swim away. Because remember, she was an incredibly strong swimmer.
Yeah.
And this caused him to panic, so he caught up with her and forcibly drowned her and then dragged her body out of the water and attempted to conceal her body, which would make sense. Because remember, she was naked, but they don't think she was sexually assaulted.
Right, and they didn't find many injuries, except that she drowned. Wow, that makes sense.
Yeah, so that's what like their main theory is, what happened.
Interesting.
Well, in the time since Ardeth's death, both Carleton University, where she did her undergrad studies, and the University of Waterloo, where she was pursuing her doctorate, they've created scholarships in her name. And at the Dominion Arboretum in Ottawa, they have an over 100-year-old Bebb's oak tree dedicated to Ardeth. And apparently, it's become like the biggest tree at the Arboretum, and it's like the only one of its species at any arboretum in North America.
Really? I've never heard of that tree. That's awesome.
Yeah. And it's known as Ardeth's tree, and it has a plaque with information. And in part, it reads, quote, "Her death touched the heart of a city," end quote.
Oh, very cool.
Well, sadly, the tree was damaged in a storm a few years ago, but thankfully it survived. It's still standing. And
good.
I'm not sure about like nowadays, but I know for several years after her murder, Ardeth's family would visit the tree. And one of her brothers, Crispin, was actually talking about cloning it, especially after it was damaged. Yeah.
Yeah. You can do that.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
In an Ottawa Citizen article, Crispin Wood explained the importance of the tree and said, quote, "This tree commemorates my sister who died under tragic circumstances. You have to appreciate life when you live it. Nothing lasts forever," end quote.
Very true. And if nothing else, since starting this podcast, I have tried to adopt just hearing sad stories day in and day out. You try to adopt something that, like, your life could end at any minute. The future means nothing if you're not living in the present. Like, you don't set your dreams on the future. Like, live in the moment and the day, right? Because God knows when it's going to end.
Yeah, like, don't wait till tomorrow.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, that is the very sad case of the murder of 27-year-old Ardith Wood. And obviously, I mean, I think this was an amazing police investigation. A lot of work went into it. But I just think, imagine if that police officer in North Bay had never seen the forensic sketch of Ardith's killer.
Right.
Who knows how many more women could have been attacked or even murdered by that monster, Christopher Myers.
Yeah, and if he would have stopped, he would have got away with it. He just could not, because there were too many witnesses left behind. He just couldn't control his urges. And that's why I think no matter how much rehabilitation, no matter how much medication, like, this guy is miswired and will always be miswired. So he is a danger to society.
You cannot fix that.
Wow. Well, I'm pumped about this block because that was a cool, that was a great introduction to forensic sketches and how helpful they can be to investigations, but also how they can really create a big time workload of things that police need to work through. So I'm very excited to keep digging into this kind of topic, and our guest will shed some amazing light on it. But before we're not going to announce until next week, but we can talk about a previous guest, Mr. Ooh. Rob Bednar. So
Rob!
I was up in the Poconos for a shoot, and I have never been sworn to secrecy like I am now. I can't tell you what network I'm working on, what show I'm working on. I can't tell you anything except that I was north of the Poconos for the past week, and I called Rob because he lives up that way, and I'm like, let's get together. I'll send Brenda will come up when the shoot's done, and you and your wife Katie can meet us for dinner. And we had a really nice dinner. We went out to Jim Thorpe. Like, Brenda and I went to Camelback, and we did zip lines and the mountain coasters and stuff. And it was just, we're in prime spooky season. Like, the leaves are gorgeous. Like, I think maybe we missed them by like a week, but it was just a gorgeous setting. The weather was perfect. It was just fall. And we hiked up this mountain. Brenda, you'll have to talk to her. She almost fell down this hill. It was hilarious.
Oh my God.
So, but it was nice to get together with Rob and we didn't talk about, we said one thing about the podcast. Like, it was really just a nice night out. It was fun.
That's
awesome. The story, do you remember earlier off camera, I told you I had a story about Rob to tell you?
Yes. So I love me some Rob. Let me hear
up
it.
Up until Friday night, he goes, oh, so where are we meeting tomorrow? And what time's Melissa getting here? And I said, Brenda? And this was over text. I said, you mean Brenda? And my phone rang within 14 milliseconds. And he was like, I thought Melissa was coming up. I thought you were up doing something from the podcast. And I said, no, I'm up doing actual work and Brenda's driving up. I said, I should have brought Melissa too and like really messed him up, brought everybody.
Oh my God, you should have.
But Brenda was actually, like, great.
I actually almost called you guys on Saturday night because I was home alone and bored. And I was like, hey, you guys are on vacation. Let me be your third wheel. I was going to make you put me on FaceTime and just bring me with you.
You should have came up. We had a real nice time, but he thought that I was bringing you. And I'm like, Rob, you know I'm not married to Melissa, right? You are aware, like, let's set that first. Like, let's just go back to the basics and let's understand that you know that, right? He's like, oh, yeah. I just thought you were bringing Melissa this time. I said, no, I'm bringing Brenda.
See, you just wanted to see me, Rob. I want to see
must.
You, too.
He must.
We'll have to schedule a visit.
Oh, man. Well, super cool story to kick us off. And I look forward to next week. We got two more big ones coming and then our guest, which I will tell you about next week. I think we can reveal
it. Yeah, I'm really excited for our guest. And actually, some of the things he's worked on other than the forensic sketches is wildly cool. So I'm really excited for that.
Yeah, this hand turkey block is pretty awesome. We're going to keep calling that behind turkey. The scenes.
Yes. I think that's what's written on like all of our paperwork for the block. So, yeah.
November block, hand turkeys.
Yep. Perfect. Well, anyway, tell us about your spooky season plans. You can hit us up on our socials, Facebook, Insta, TikTok, Blue Sky. I feel like there's another one, but I don't
know.
Just search.
Is it Reddit?
Well, there is Reddit. I was going to say that separately, but just search for Murder Unscripted. We'll be there. We're cool. Yeah. We promise.
One of us.
Not me. Not this one. Or you can shoot us an email, murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can send us a note through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
Those are the places.
Well, we will see everyone next week. And until then, stay safe, stay hydrated, and remember, Perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
Sometimes they don't even wear shirts, but they do wear temporary tattoos.
Oh my God, what a nerd.
Beware.
Beware. Bye. See ya.